Okay, I will call the Property Tax Division March 6, 2024 meeting to order. We do have quorum and can conduct lawful business. First on the agenda is to approve the minutes from February 21st. Do I have a motion?
I move to approve the minutes.
Vice Chair Lee approves. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Okay, we have a pretty full agenda today. I think our first bill, we're going to House File 3715. She's already there. Welcome, Representative. I will move that House File 3715 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. Representative Abadji, to your bill, please.
Thank you so much, Chair Lislegard. It is a pleasure to be in your committee today. So I also have an A1 amendment, so I don't know if you want to move that now or...
Sure. I will move the A1 amendment. Could you speak to your amendment, please?
Yes. Chair and members, the A1 amendment provides an enactment date for the bill. So it would make the enactment date October 1 of 2024, which complies with kind of the quarterly collecting of sales taxes. And if Ms. Hagler has any further details on that, I welcome her to add. So.
Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and members, under streamlined requirement, any changes to the sales tax rates have to start on calendar quarters and give 60 days notice. So the bill as introduced was effective August 1st, 2024. However, this amendment is just pushing that date back to comply with the streamlined requirements.
Okay. Any questions from members? If not, all those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. To your amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. So today I'm presenting House File 3715 as amended. This bill allows for an expansion of the downtown district in Minneapolis to include the neighborhood known as the North Loop. Over the years, the North Loop District has grown and become another focal point in the city for small businesses, restaurants, and entertainment. The focus of this bill is to better define the area that is classified as downtown in the Central Business District of Minneapolis. The bill is revenue neutral. Currently, Minneapolis has a restaurant and liquor tax rate of 3% each. Both of those tax rates would decrease to 2.5% to maintain revenue neutrality over the new expanded area. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifier and take questions.
Thank you so much. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lislegard and committee members. My name is Katie Topinka. I'm the Director of Intergovernmental Relations for the City of Minneapolis, and happy to be here to testify in support of House File 3715 today, and thank you to Representative Bagé for carrying this. As Representative Bagé mentioned, this bill would expand the boundary for the Minneapolis Downtown Taxing District while lowering the rate to keep it revenue neutral. This new rate would apply to the downtown liquor tax and the downtown restaurant tax, lowering it from 3% to 2.5%. And this new rate is based on analysis that was done by the Department of Revenue, so thank you to the department for doing that. Downtown Minneapolis has seen significant growth and change since the adoption of the existing boundary. The city is seeking this new boundary to encompass a geography that brings it more in line with the scope of downtown activity as it exists today, most notably incorporating the North Loop. The existing and proposed new boundaries are shown in the map that you have before you. The change includes encompassing the whole geography of the North Loop and Elliott Park neighborhoods. This change is supported by the Minneapolis City Council and has been requested by businesses downtown in order to achieve parity between restaurants and entertainment venues in parts of downtown that are in the existing boundary and then businesses in the North Loop. And this is a sales tax that's of course paid by customers, not directly by businesses, but it does lower the rate for all of those businesses in downtown by expanding the boundary. So with that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Okay, thank you so much. Before we go to member questions, anyone in the audience want to speak for or against? Okay, thank you. Seeing none, members. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Lislegard. I just had a quick question. I just am looking at this map, and there's two exclusions. One looks like maybe it's MCTC, and then there's this tiny little other one over on the other side of the river, and I'm just wondering if you could let me know what properties those are. Thank you.
I'm not sure which one would like to take that.
Probably for Ms. Topinka. I don't know.
Ms. Topinka?
We can follow up, too, if that works.
Yes, Chair Lagarde and Chair Gomez, you were right on the larger one. I will have to go check on the smaller one. And also, the intention is to also exclude the farmer's market as well.
Anything else, Chair Gomez? Okay, thank you. Representative Guam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. About how many businesses that weren't under this tax are now on it? Just sort of an idea of, you know, the quantity of businesses that now see the tax.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, that is another question that I would have to get back to you on to confirm. We can certainly look at the number of restaurants and bars in that area. If they don't have liquor licenses through the city, we may not have the precise data, but we can certainly get you a number of licensed liquor businesses in the new boundary and report that back to the committee.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because the statement was made that it's revenue neutral and there was a sort of a fiscal note, I assume that you already knew that. So, yeah, if you're offline, you can let us know. Thank you.
Anyone else? Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Abadji or to the testifier, just remind the committee what the use of the tax revenues are going to be used for.
Representative Abadji.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll have Ms. Topinka provide further details.
Ms. Topinka.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. The tax proceeds are used for a number of different purposes. It's for downtown assets. So it's primarily for the convention center, for Target Center, which is owned by the city of Minneapolis, PV Plaza, which is a plaza near Nicollet Mall, and then also for U.S. Bank Stadium. So a portion of these sales taxes are retained by the state to pay for the purposes that the city is obligated to pay toward U.S. Bank Stadium.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. That's helpful. The other question I have is, because we're expanding the area, and I understand from the testimony that it's because of like businesses, like things to be more homogeneous on that, which makes a lot of sense, and therefore the tax can come down because it's revenue neutral on that. I'm assuming that those neighborhoods and those areas that we're including also see that they would benefit from the current use of those taxes and that there isn't any kind of internal opposition by expanding that in overall reduction of the tax, that they consider themselves to be one of the musketeers, if I can use that analogy.
Ms. Topinka.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, yes, I mean, this is something that's supported by our council, including the council members who support that area, who have engaged with businesses and stakeholders around this change. And so we are not aware of opposition.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and thank you to the testifier.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Okay, closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. I appreciate your consideration of this bill and the larger property tax bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair renews his motion that House File 3715, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. It is laid over. Next up, we have Representative Norris with House File 4265. Chair moves that House File 4265 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. And to your bill, Representative Norris.
Thank you, Chair Liz Lagarde and members. It's great to be back in front of the Property Tax Division. Land banks have proven to be a valuable tool for promoting the development and preservation of affordable housing and Main Street businesses. One of the ways they achieve those goals is by purchasing and taking title to property, then holding it for a specified amount of time, and then selling it to mission-oriented owners. One of the costs incurred while holding that property is, of course, property taxes. Reducing that property tax bill reduces holding costs, allows the land bank to sell the property to the ultimate owner for a lower cost, which then allows that ultimate owner to utilize the property for its mission-driven purpose at a lower cost, whether that's affordably housing people or providing space for small businesses and entrepreneurs. This bill achieves this goal by giving local taxing jurisdictions the option to abate property taxes for land bank held properties. I'll emphasize that this is purely optional. If local officials wish to utilize this tool, they can. If they don't wish to, they're not required to. But this is one important way that communities can help land banks accomplish their mission more efficiently. Thank you, Chair Lissagard.
Thank you. And I do believe you have a testifier. Could you state your name for the record and proceed?
Certainly. Good morning, and thank you, Chair Lissagard and Representatives Norris, Chair Gomez, Davidson, Howard for being authors on this bill. I'm Tom Streitz, President and co-founder of the Land Bank Twin Cities. Very pleased to be here this morning. Thank you, Representative Norris, for your belief in this. And you have in your handout some pretty dramatic documents that really detail the impact this entity has had over the years. So I just want to take a moment to say I founded the Land Bank in 2009. During the height of the foreclosure crisis, I was the City of Minneapolis' housing director as I watched hundreds of low-income homeowners lose their life savings and their homeownership dreams as a result of predatory lending to large multinational corporations that had no connection or long-term interest in our community. The inspiration for the Land Bank was simple: to create a locally owned and controlled financial partner to benefit low-income families with long-term community benefit in mind. Since our founding, the Land Bank has been a force for good in our community, as evidenced in the handouts that you have, and it's helped create thousands of new rental units and hundreds of new low-income homeowners who've reached their dream again. We have also assisted neighborhoods in preserving historical assets. The Victoria Theater in St. Paul, we purchased it for the neighborhood they now own. Indigenous Roots, a great local prophet in St. Paul, had a landlord, and they called us. They said, you know, this landlord's not great. This isn't going well. We said, well, what if we buy the building and sell it to you? They own it. So, you know, this has been this machine, as you can see, where if you put some money in, and you partner in the community and you have long-term benefit in mind, really good results happen as a result of that. So why should the state grant counties the option to abate taxes temporarily under this bill? Three simple reasons. All savings realized by this abatement inure directly to the benefit of low-income homeowners and lower mortgage payments to renters and lower rental payments. And here's the really other cool thing. Number two is, in the end, the community and the taxing jurisdiction has a lot more money. A dollar forgiven to the land bank temporarily results in, as you can see, 320% return to the taxing jurisdiction in the end, 220%, 300%. It's pretty magical. And then finally, this is not a mandate. It's an option. If a community or a county says this tool doesn't work for us, don't call us. If it does work, and as you can see, it really does work, call us. We're here. I have this amazing staff, Scott, Garrett, Eddie, Shanna, and just a great team of people. And finally, let me say this. Can you imagine a locally owned and operated bank in your community where you can pick up the phone, talk to a real person, and find a partner willing to take a risk to help you achieve your dreams? I did, and it's called the Land Bank Twin Cities. Thank you.
Nicely done. Mary Ann Kiros?
Chair Lissagard, I don't think she's with us today.
Okay.
So if I may, yes. Mr. Chair.
You sure can.
I do have with us this morning, real briefly, Eddie Landenberger, who's our Vice President of Strategic Acquisition. He wants to highlight one example of our work.
Well, come on down, Eddie.
Eddie, come on down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and representatives. Because Mary Ann couldn't make it here today, I just wanted to speak a little bit about the project that she was involved in. So we received a call from Mary Ann. She is the ED of a nonprofit, Indigenous Roots, in a small commercial building up the hill in Dayton's Bluff. One of the problematic landlords in the area came up to her and said, I'm going to buy this building, and your rent is probably going to double. She called us, not knowing what to do, but heard about the services that we provide, and asked us if we could help her with this building. So we ended up land banking it, and in the process got to know all the other local businesses that were there, some of whom were small local businesses that had been in this building for up to 12 years, a Kinsiera dress shop that had been there, and wasn't able to stay in the building if this new landlord was going to purchase the building. So we bought the building, we land banked it for them, and today all the tenants are still there with this ownership opportunity.
Great story. Thank you. Before we get to the amendment, anyone in the audience want to speak for or against? Seeing none, we do have an amendment. It's the A1, and I would like to, Representative Quam, if you could explain the amendment, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the A1 amendment. And the intent and the activities are commendable. It allows local governments to be involved and assist in the development. If, in the rare occasion, it doesn't work out and it ends up being that land is used for something outside, there'd be the option of doing this, clawback of the abatement. And it just meant, make sure that we have more incentive to continue that partnership. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I would go to Representative Norris.
Yeah. Chair Lislegarde, Representative Quam, thank you for bringing forward this amendment. We agree that it's a smart thing to do. We've talked with the advocates. We have no concerns about it. So I would accept it as a friendly amendment.
Holy, go look at this.
Bipartisanship in action.
All right. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. All right. So with it being amended,
just one last point here is we're actively now the land bank. We have started a new innovative program where we're buying back from Wall Street and large corporate investors single family homes and getting homeowners and their people of color and low income families. Something I'm very proud of. Just had to say that. Thank you.
Okay. We're going to open up to member questions. This is a kumbaya moment. Somebody get it. Oh, thank you, Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to commend Rep. Norris for bringing this bill before the committee and thank Tom for the work he's done in our communities. And although Indigenous Roots is not in my district, it is across the street from my district. And so appreciate your help in our part of town.
Anyone else? Okay. Before I turn it over to you for closing comments, I just want to thank Representative Quam for bringing a wonderful amendment that benefits the bill and makes it a stronger bill. So thank you so much. And for last closing comments, Representative Knorr.
Yeah. Thank you, Chair Lislegarde. I think we've heard some great examples today of the tremendous work that land banks can do in our communities. And I think the idea of allowing local jurisdictions to use property tax abatement to help them do it more efficiently makes a lot of sense, and I hope that we can find a way to get this bill into the final tax bill.
Okay. With that, the chair renews his motion that House File 4265, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. The bill is laid over. Okay. Next up, we have House File 3585, Representative Bonner. Welcome. The chair moves that House File 3585 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. Representative Bonner, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very excited to be here before the Property Tax Division today. I hear this is where all the good action happens.
Where all the cool kids hang out.
That's right. That's right. All right. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. I appreciate the opportunity to share a bit about the incredible growth in Maple Grove and seek your help to continue that prosperity well into the future. Maple Grove is currently the 8th fastest growing city in the state with the 2nd largest concentration of retail outside of the Mall of America. Young families have found Maple Grove to be a tremendous place to live, while thriving businesses from med tech to generic drug manufacturers and deed award winners produce innovative products from baking kits and candles to medical devices. And big companies like Boston Scientific are anxious to expand and grow in our thriving community. We are here today to ask you to extend the timeline on our TIF district, originally created in 2014 and extended in 2017, to address soil deficiencies in the undeveloped gravel mining area. In 2017, the TIF district was extended to develop a second area of soil deficiency. This TIF district has been a resounding success, resulting in the development of nearly 1.5 million square feet of industry, and development, and in an area that is now thriving. Our ask today is to extend the TIF district for an additional 5 years beyond the original extension in 2017, which would bring it from 8 to 13, for the collection of increment financing. We're also seeking to expand the larger project area to allow the allocation of funds for the development of infrastructure improvements to cover the cost to serve the newly expanded district. Specifically, this would allow funds for needed improvements to the primary point of access to the district at U.S. Highway 169 and County Road 130 interchange. This extension is critical to sustain the momentum to further develop this 2,000-acre gravel mining area and support the needed safety and operational improvements vital to this access point and the new business development. I appreciate your time today to review our proposal that will allow Maple Grove to continue to thrive and grow. And with that, I am going to turn it over to my testifier, our very tremendous city administrator, to further illuminate the details of the proposal.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Heidi Nelson. I serve as the city administrator for the city of Maple Grove. We appreciate the opportunity to provide testimony today on House File 3585, which provides amendments to the city's gravel mining area TIF district. I'll review in general some of the same things that Representative Bonner did, but provide a little more technical information with regard to the requested amendments. This requested amendments extends the five-year rule to 13 years. As mentioned, the five-year rule was extended to 8 years in 2017. This request to extend the timeline to enter projects into the district is due to impacts of the pandemic, supply chain, and interest rate conditions. This legislation also would extend the life of the district from 20 to 25 years. It changes the project area for pooling to be coterminous with the city boundaries to account for infrastructure needs in the area of the TIF district development. This bill would qualify land acquisition as an eligible cost in the district, and it explicitly adds language that speaks to the reconstruction of 169 Elm Creek Boulevard, also known as County Road 30, interchange as an eligible expense for pooling dollars. That interchange was originally constructed in 1984 and has a deficient design with stacked signals, no turn lanes, and no pedestrian improvements. That interchange also serves Hennepin Technical College, which is just located to the east in Brooklyn Park. With that, I again appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning and would stand for any questions that the chair or committee might have.
Okay, thank you. Anyone else in the audience want to speak for or against the bill? Seeing none, open it up for member discussion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, you mentioned a land acquisition. I would ask, are we talking about private acquisition or city acquisition to some of these areas in that gravel area?
Ms. Nelson.
Chair, members of the committee, so originally the legislation did allow for city acquisition of land. This change would allow for land acquisition by a developer to be an eligible expense under the TIF district.
Representative Anderson. No. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, and to the testifier, thank you for being here. As someone who represents a second-tier suburb, why does a growing, prosperous, high-income second-tier suburb need tax incentives for development?
Ms. Nelson.
Chair, members of the committee, so Maple Grove has a long history of a strong retail environment. As we look to the future of our community, and if you're familiar with the area, this gravel mining area is particularly located just sort of due east of where Costco and Lowe's and that retail area is. We knew that we needed to shift gears away from additional retail land. We needed to refocus our energy on the growth of industry and jobs in the community. I think any community that is focusing on the growth of industry and jobs needs to have economic development tools at the table to be competitive and to be successful. The most recent example with Boston Scientific is we were in competition with Boston and Atlanta for that new Boston Scientific campus that'll bring keeps about 1,000 jobs here in Minnesota, but also adds about 200 jobs to that campus. but for having these types of tools, we wouldn't have been able to be competitive to bring that type of industry and job growth to Maple Grove. So I recognize that Maple Grove on its face appears to be a very wealthy suburb. I think we need to be competitive just like any other community in bringing that type of industry and development to Maple Grove. In addition, Maple Grove has been very prudent in its use of tax increment financing. This gravel mining area is really our only area of tax increment financing that exists in the city.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the testifier. I appreciate the answer. The when you're talking about competing for development, is that with other jurisdictions within Minnesota, or would you say it's more for out of state?
Ms. Nelson.
Chair, members of the committee, in that example with Boston Scientific, that was a competition with Atlanta and Boston. And so we are really in the national marketplace when it comes to med tech development. And that is an important component of the growth of the industry in Maple Grove. There are times when a business or a company comes from a neighboring community when maybe they don't have room to grow where they are, or maybe they are in a facility that no longer serves their needs. We see that as an opportunity to allow that company to grow here in the state of Minnesota and maybe not leave Minnesota. We also see following on in those communities, my neighbors from Plymouth are here, and we often see folks, you know, moving around in Plymouth, coming to Maple Grove where they might have a little bit more space. I assure you that those spaces then are backfilled in Plymouth, and Plymouth is doing just fine with that. So I think it's all part of the regional economy.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you again to the testifier. You can understand that as a legislator, it's confusing for me when my friend to my left over here, and she is to my left, no doubt about that, when she is bemoaning the fact that businesses and developers don't pay enough in taxes in Minnesota, and she's doing everything she can to raise costs, and then we have local units of government coming in saying, let's do things to reduce costs to expand development. It's kind of like one hand of government doesn't know what the other hand is doing, but maybe my friend to my left will have a different opinion about that she can share. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And here we go. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My friend to my right thinks that we should leave everything to the invisible hand, so maybe we're talking different hands here. Seriously, though, I do want to just, you know, I feel I have a certain role as the tax scold, as I've identified myself before. I just want us all to think about the fact that a lot of tax increment financing is allowed under statute by right. Every time we see a TIF bill in front of this committee, it means that they are asking for permission to diverge from those very clearly outlined applications of TIF in statute. And like it or not, these deviations from existing state policy create precedents. And, or not precedents, precedents, if I maybe mispronounced that. But so, you know, expanding a TIF district to encompass an entire city that's a high wealth city, that using TIF proceeds not just to address blight conditions, but to do things like fix roads and bridges, or you know, these county roads and highways, allowing, you know, extending the 5-year rule, allowing increment to be spent outside of the district. I mean, these are all like different uses of TIF than TIF was designed to be used for, frankly. And so, you know, these things a lot of times come down to kind of like politics rather than policy. And I think that we need to apply consistent policy to these requests and just be really clear-eyed about what we're doing for kind of the future. Because if we allow you guys to do this, next year there's going to be another project that says, oh, wait, you allowed Maple Grove to extend their TIF district to encompass the entire city. You allowed it to be used to improve roads, which is something that the cities usually go to their property tax levy to provide those improvements. And, you know, so like, are we going to let people use TIF for roads that aren't connected to a blighted property? I mean, that's a serious policy question for us as people who have to think about property tax policy to consider. And so, you know, I mean, it's similar with the next TIF proposal. So, you know, when you see one of these house research summaries that has all this long list of the exceptions to the TIF that you can do by right without coming here, without asking us for any exceptions, like every city can use TIF in the way that it was outlined in the law. And so every single one of these is a deviation from the law as it exists. And I just really want us to be very thoughtful and very careful about granting exceptions to the law as it exists, and, you know, potentially creating precedent, especially, you know, Representative Garofalo talked about, I believe that we asked for information about adjusted net tax capacity. I haven't seen that, but maybe I missed it. It's possible. But, you know, we do have to look when cities come and ask us for exceptions to TIF rules in order to fund uses that mostly should be on the property tax levy, we have to look at what is your capacity to use your existing property tax base and a levy to pay for it? What is your utilization of your levy authority right now compared to that adjusted net tax capacity and compared to your peer communities? Because we could potentially create a lot of distortions overall in our kind of tax code by granting a lot of exceptions. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
So I would just, yeah, no, seriously, I'd like to remind everyone that the right hand washes the left hand washes the right hand, and we're going to go to Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to my distinguished colleagues, the two that spoke before me who are both to my right. One of the things that I've noticed over the years is that there are times when Minnesota cities are competing with neighboring states and even other farther states. I have seen projects that had hundreds of millions of dollars of capital investment go to Iowa because they were offered certain things that allowed for them to afford the initial investment. And, you know, the TIF that helps bring in hundreds of jobs and then the ripple effect of other jobs in the community provides for opportunity for members of across that community to be able to work and earn a living and support their families. And I think that's a valid reason why local government would say, we need to do this to, you know, help our people and help our city and the community. And so I understand, I think, what these deviant projects, I mean these divergent projects, irritate sometimes, but we need to understand that not every community is exactly like ours, and there are specific needs and different circumstances for the community. So we can drive by and see, wow, that's a beautiful looking community. But if they don't do certain things in 10 years, it might be a totally different setup. So planning of the community by the elected officials, I think, is a valid thing for us to enable. And if there's a specific issue with the plan, then we should address that issue. But I haven't heard anything that directly says, oh, this is a bad use of the land, or this is going to be detrimental to a portion of the community. So I will, in this case, I'm trusting the local leaders. And so I'm okay with this TIF bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I promise to be succinct. And this may go beyond the scope of this committee, but I think to pick up on Representative Garofalo's comments, Minnesota has the highest or one of the highest corporate tax rates in the country. And I think then it becomes necessary for cities like Maple Grove, if they're going to compete with Atlanta or Boston for one of these outstanding projects, they, to be competitive, they need to offer things like this to make up for our corporate tax rate. So, this particular project seems like a good one, but again, we should view these in the entire scope of our tax policy in the state, and that would be in the bigger tax committee. But I would hope that we would do that at some point. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a question to the testifier. How many acres of mining does this encompass?
Ms. Nelson, this is a very important question.
It is a very important question. I'm sorry, I do have those numbers. Chair, members of the committee, I do have those numbers here, and let me page through my information so that I give you an accurate accounting of that.
You know what, you can get back to me.
Okay.
But I'm going to go along with Representative Chair Goldmez on some of this, because I, right away when you did this, as you know, now I'm from a poor farming community and Rosemount's struggling to develop. We've done some good things lately, but poor farming community, like I said. And this part of the community is actually Representative Garofalo's, and I'm surprised you didn't bring it up. But we have a mining project going on there that is paying for TCF Stadium right now. Huntington Stadium, yes. And so when that's done, I could just replace the word Maple Grove with Rosemount, and I'm all for this. I think this is a great idea, because then we can bring in big business and, you know, be competitive. So I'm excited, exactly what you told me I should be, Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt, and I've been excited ever since I heard mining like 17 times today. And so they won me over with that. So Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will try and be quick. One, first quick question for nonpartisan staff. This bill expands the allowable area in which increment can be spent to include the entire city, basically, of Maple Grove. And just curious if you're aware, and if it's okay, you can get back to me too. Is that something that's been done before? Is that commonly done? I'm just kind of curious about that piece of it.
Ms. Hagler.
Mr. Chair and Representative Coulter, I believe that it has been done in some specific cases, maybe in last year or the year before that. I don't know exactly which cities we've done it before, but this isn't a super uncommon ask.
Thank you. Thank you. That's helpful. And I guess I would just close in sort of emphasizing a point that I made before, that I think what we see often with a lot of these TIP bills is local communities being challenged to provide resources for economic development, which is something that cities need to do. I served on city council. I served on a housing redevelopment authority. I know that that's an important piece, and I think cities are just increasingly challenged to do that with the resources that they have available. So I think that needs, as we talk about unmet need for our local partners, I think that needs to be part of the conversation as well.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Chair Gomez's comments, I actually two things came to mind. Number one, the words that were coming out of her mouth reminded me of words that came out of the mouths of people. Maybe no one around this table remembers, but Representatives Phil Kroenke, Representatives Ron Abrams, and Representative Jim Knobloch, when he was in the legislature the first time, they were sort of the iron fists of the tax committee. And I know, because I was sitting in that testifying area asking them for help and different things from the local community. What I've come to learn in my time in local government and here at the legislature is there are two types of wealth. There's the type of wealth that one earns as an income, and there's the wealth that a community has in the way of tax base for improvements in businesses and the like. And the problem that you have is when you say a community is wealthy, they may not be able to access the kind of wealth for the needs that the community has for infrastructure through income tax, because that is where the state of Minnesota and the federal government have jurisdiction. Where the local communities have jurisdiction is through property taxes. And by raising property taxes in a property poor or not as wealthy of a tax base, you burden the homeowners in those districts. And why I say that that's very interesting, the way she talks about that, is because there's another side of this coin that we need to be looking at as well with this wealth issue. My district is probably a net contributor to the state of Minnesota in tax revenue from an income standpoint. We are a property poor as far as development goes community. So the folks in my district get to pay about $1,000 to $2,000 or more than districts in the metro for education, because we don't have equalization on that. And that's a problem, because those folks are not going to be able to, they're going to have to pay on the local levy for their education, and they're also going to have to pay for the roads, the bridges, and things where they don't get the other income coming in. And so the system maybe needs to be addressed about how we're doing these things. And maybe this is the canary in the mine, saying it's time to start looking at some of these tools and bringing them into the 21st century as tools that communities can use, and maybe doing a revamping so that, as many are fond of saying, one Minnesota, we can actually be taking care of all of Minnesota. There's not a question, just a rant here. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my question here is, the district that borders this, and we share that intersection that they're talking about, that's in here about improvements to that, which with the amount of traffic that's going back and forth across Osseo Road and Elm Creek Boulevard that joins there, it changes names at that intersection. Have you approached Brooklyn Park about, if you're looking to get that bridge improved, about where they are at this? Because the way the transportation works is they're going to have to pay part of the cost of that bridge replacement and improvement, their share, along with Maple Grove, because it's a shared bridge. The county and the state all would be part of that. But have you approached Brooklyn Park with that as you're moving forward on working on getting that bridge replaced?
Ms. Nelson.
Chair, members of the committee, thank you, Representative Nelson, for that question. We have been in conversation with the city of Brooklyn Park. I'll give a little information about this interchange project. So roughly $19.3 million in cost to replace this interchange. We would do it in a diverging diamond design, which would allow us to keep the lanes in place while we construct the new interchange. I will say, I think this bridge is more important to us than it is to Brooklyn Park. I think they have other priorities as they're looking at other blue line construction, those types of things that are calling for their capital investment dollars to be focused there. Having said that, we do remain in conversation not only with Hennepin County but also Brooklyn Park for this project. We are also pursuing other dollars, so we have received $7 million from the regional solicitation program through Met Council towards this project, and we also have a freight application in with MnDOT right now and are awaiting award there. So really the use of tax increment financing in supporting this infrastructure project is sort of the cleanup batting, right? It's the last dollars in that would be used to support this infrastructure project. I have the opportunity, want to respond to a couple of questions. So the overall gravel mining area in Maple Grove is about 2,000 acres. The area that's currently under development is 300 acres that is either in active development or prepared for development today. The Boston Scientific Project, for example, is about 40 acres, and there's about 60 acres north of that up to Elm Creek Boulevard that is available for active development that we think within the next 3 to 5 years we'll likely see active development.
Representative Nelson, is that good?
That's good, thank you.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, closing comments. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for the lively debate. I think one of the things that I want to emphasize, too, is I'm incredibly proud of our city council. They have done a marvelous job of being very judicious in the way we use our resources. Maple Grove is in a very good position because of their very conservative, very judicious approaches to developing land over time. And even with this request, it is, again, a very judicious way to look at how we approach this and how we meet the needs of our community. So I'm grateful for the lively debate today and certainly would love to have the support of the committee to continue to move this forward.
Well, you won me over because you got mining. So, the chair renews his motion that House File 3585 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. It is laid over.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're all still doing kumbaya. The next one up is House File 3604, Representative Cleavorn. The chair moves that House File 3604 be laid over for possible inclusion in the tax division, property tax division on this report. And if I may, with members, I never want to cut anyone off, but we just had a very long conversation about, you know, different viewpoints. And so if we could just stick to the subject matter on this one, that would be greatly appreciated. So, Representative Cleavorn, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so as I was listening to the last, I changed everything that I was going to say. I will ask your indulgence as we get through this presentation. And I did hear kumbaya on both sides of the table. I want to begin, Chair Gomez, by saying I hear you. And I appreciate the responsibility that you take as chair of taxes. And looking at all of these policies, you and I have some policies that we would love to rip apart, right? But the diligence that you take in your job, I just want to recognize and acknowledge. And I understand that there are really difficult situations that you have to face and deal with as we look at the best way to use state resources everywhere. So I just want to honor that. Now, as I say that, I will also say that current law doesn't fit our needs. We are trying to be super responsible, both to our community and to our state. Communities all across our state have needs, and I'm appreciative of the careful consideration that each of you gives to every piece of legislation that comes before you. As we know, there are cities like Plymouth that developed in yesteryear. Right? We've come to you asking for state bonding for farm-to-market roads that no longer meet the needs of a city of 82,000. And growing communities do have needs, and communities that are built out have needs, right? Whether it's changing zoning. So we always have to look at that. When I say Plymouth is a city that was developed in yesteryear, I want to talk about the fact that we have unused surface lots that we need to get rid of so that we can put in housing. We have roads we need to dig up because they don't meet the water runoff. They don't meet the needs that we have for our climate and our transportation needs. We need to, in a community that was built in yesteryear without sidewalks, and we need to think about bike safety, pedestrian safety, multimodal ways of transportation. And that's where these funds are going to be used. And that's why I need your help. We also have seniors who moved into Plymouth who cannot afford one more penny on their property tax. And if we raise our levy and raise our levy and raise our levy to try to meet those needs, we are also making those people homeless. And so I'm trying to balance the needs of those who have lived there a really long time and this is their home against the ability of people who live there who can afford to pay a little bit more, right? So we are happy in Plymouth to pay our fair share. We are a net money out. We are an outflow community. And so I believe that we do pay our fair share, and sometimes when we need changes in the TIF law to meet our needs, I ask for you to consider that in the big picture equation. And you've read the bill, you know what I'm asking, so I'm not gonna dive into that, but I will ask if you would acknowledge Mr. Chair, our mayor, to speak about the needs of the bill. So.
Thank you. Mayor, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Jeff Washey, I'm the mayor of Plymouth. Mr. Chair and committee members, the city requests the authority to use tax increment financing to support infrastructure improvements needed to pave the way for redevelopment in the heart of the city, Plymouth City Center. roughly defined as the geographic center of Plymouth, 1 mile west of Interstate 494 on Highway 55. The area contains entertainment venues, sports, fitness facilities, businesses, restaurants, and other destinations. Investment in public infrastructure is needed to cultivate a welcoming downtown. Funding will improve walkability and pedestrian safety, strengthen mobility and transit connectivity, allow for bus rapid transit, bolster environmental sustainability, provide public parking, support a mix of housing opportunities, create community gathering spaces, and contribute to the success of our business community. Proposed infrastructure improvements include three priorities. First, redesigning the area's central roadway, Plymouth Boulevard, to help create a walkable downtown with safer crossings, slower traffic, and improved access to restaurants, retail, and recreation. Second, regional ponding to modernize stormwater infrastructure and offer redevelopment flexibility, allowing for increased density and mobility through new housing opportunities and bus rapid transit. And finally, construction of a public parking ramp to help alleviate parking constraints, strengthen transit connectivity, and pave the way for potential bus rapid transit on Highway 55. Chair and committee members, using TIF within Plymouth City Center is a very important issue for the city's future. Fostering safety and access in the area will help pave the way for vibrant redevelopment, bringing more restaurants, retail, and foot traffic to downtown Plymouth. TIF funding would also help support affordable housing and transit opportunity. We respectfully request that you support this authorization. And we also have Grant Fernelius, our Director of Economic and Community Development, to answer any questions as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone from the audience that would like to speak for or against before we go to member discussion? Seeing none, Representative Coulter.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cleburne, for the discussion and the comments you made. I think we all appreciate, you know, I represent a community of a certain age as well, and much like people of a certain age, things just don't work the way they used to.
No ageist comments, please.
yes. My question, I'm just curious, and Mayor or Mr. Fernelius, maybe you could speak this. I'm just curious, the flexibility that you're requesting, could you perhaps just go into a little bit more detail about the kinds of things that you anticipate these funds being spent on?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Grant Fernelius, and I am the Community and Economic Development Director for the City of Plymouth. To answer the question about why we want the flexibility, it's primarily related to infrastructure improvements. This is a large area. City Center is roughly 130 acres. There are multiple parcels. It does function as our downtown. And as Representative Cleavorn mentioned, you know, we have needs. It is an area that was developed at one point, you know, 30 plus years ago, and those needs have changed. And so one of the things that we need to do is invest in the infrastructure elements. So as the mayor mentioned, Plymouth Boulevard is one of the key pieces of infrastructure that we want to install, as well as a public parking ramp that will help alleviate traffic concerns. There are a lot of visitors that come to our downtown core, and like many communities, trying to be responsible with resiliency and those kinds of issues, we want to centralize parking so that people can park once and walk throughout our downtown. So really this bill is intended to give us flexibility for infrastructure improvements to make our downtown more vibrant.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
May I just add to that answer as well? We have these surface lots that are spread out, and by consolidating the parking, we are able to take those surface lots and redevelop them for housing density and for other uses that would be important for the community, whether it's senior development or whatever it might be. And so I just want to make sure that when somebody hears consolidated parking, they understand that that frees up that land for the housing that we desperately need as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Coulter?
Thank you.
Anyone else? Any other member? Representative Anderson.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. But maybe this will be a question for Mr. Swanson. And you've kind of talked on this, but one of the special rules you're asking for is to use these funding dollars outside the district. Is that an unusual request for TIF spending to be used outside the designated TIF area?
Alex?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, I think your question is likely similar to Representative Coulter's question from the previous Maple Grove bill. And again, it's not an uncommon request for, especially when a district needs to be established via special law like this one. As I said, it's not super uncommon, but I suppose it's maybe just in the fact that these districts don't meet the like statutory requirements for redevelopment districts such as this one, the expenditure outside of the district kind of ties into the need for those special rules. Makes sense.
Representative Anderson.
No.
Thank you. Anyone else? Closing comments, Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, and I would just like to say to that question, if I can just answer it quickly, is that, you know, when you're talking about blight requirements, there really has to be a building to blight, right? We can't meet the blighting requirements if there's nothing there to destroy, right? So it is, there are, that's why the, it's, as I often hear, law is written, but one size does not fit all. And in this particular case, we're asking for those exceptions so that we can meet the unique needs that we have in our community that both benefit our community as well as our region, because our region is served by our community since we're the largest community in that area. And so it is beneficial to many people outside of the Plymouth district as well. And with that, Mr. Chair, I just want to thank you for allowing us this opportunity to be with you today and for the consideration that you will give us and helping us meet our needs going forward. And I ask for your support and ask for this to be included in your division report. And then I'll work with Chair Gomez. Thank you.
Well, you knew exactly where to go on that one. I'm obviously going to lay this over for possible inclusion, but I just want to say whether it's Maple Grove, Bloomington, or Plymouth, I want you guys to be successful because you guys and other communities that are doing very, very well help those of us in certain areas that don't quite have that opportunity, even though we're trying so hard. It's just location and lack of opportunities. So the more success you have, it also helps the whole state of Minnesota. So I want you to be successful. You don't have to say anymore. I want you to be successful. So
Thank you very much. With that,
the chair moves that House File 3604 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. It's laid over. Okay, next up, is this the last one? Oh, look at this. All right. Next up is House File 3414. Representative Coulter moves that House File 3414 be laid over for possible inclusion into the Property Tax Division report. Representative Coulter, two-year bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I am indeed here with House File 3414, and sort of set the stage for this conversation. I would just kind of ask folks to think about, when you book a hotel, do you go to the hotel website, or do you go to hotels.com, Travelocity, Priceline, or some other online travel company? If you're booking a hotel in the state of Minnesota, that choice could mean the difference between communities getting the local lodging tax that they would otherwise be entitled to and them not receiving that local lodging tax. 117, and actually I think my list might be a little bit out of date. I think it's now 118 because Woodbury is not on my list, but I think their local lodging tax just came online recently. So over 100 communities across Minnesota have a local lodging tax. Seven currently are administered by the state of Minnesota, and the remainder, over 100, are locally administered. Currently, online travel companies pay local lodging taxes for rooms that are booked within those communities with state-administered local lodging taxes. House File 3414 would extend that to all locally administered local lodging tax communities as well. To be clear, this does not change the rate rates for local lodging taxes. It does not change allowable uses or anything like that. It simply extends that sort of equality to all communities across the state with locally administered local lodging taxes. And this would indeed benefit the entire state. Of the communities that were on my list, some 80 communities with local lodging taxes are outside of the Twin Cities Metro. And many of them are represented by members of this community on both sides of the aisle. So I think this is fundamentally a measure of fairness and ensuring that local governments and convention and visitors bureaus and so on have the resources that they would otherwise be entitled to use for tourism and promotion and that sort of thing. So with that, I will move things along.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Coulter. We do have Nathan Jessen here to testify on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Jessen. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. Also included in your packets is a letter I provided with some additional background. So as Representative Coulter noted, the main issue this bill would address is the current disparity between what local lodging tax revenue is subject to taxation depending on how the tax is administered. So under current law, if you book a room in a city with a local lodging tax by calling the hotel or going directly to the hotel website and you spend, let's say, $100 on that room, you pay local lodging tax on all of that $100. But if you book a room at the same hotel in the same location using an online travel company website, you only pay lodging tax on the portion of the purchase that the hotel retains. So let's say an online travel company keeps $10 of that $100. I'm just using round numbers here because they're simple, just as an example. So that $10 is not currently subject to local lodging taxes for local lodging taxes that are administered by the city. But if it's a local lodging tax that's administered by the state, it is subject to local lodging taxes. So as Representative Coulter noted, there are a number of communities with state-administered lodging taxes. That includes St. Paul, Minneapolis, and Rochester, amongst a few others. Questions have come up about administrability of this proposal. I think it's always fair to ask those questions. But I think you've also got to look at the current lay of land when you're assessing whether or not a proposal is administrable. And what I can tell you is that these online travel companies and other accommodation intermediaries are currently paying sales tax on these purchases, and that includes local sales taxes and multiple rates on that front too. So I'd just like to thank Representative Coulter for carrying the bill and the committee for the time to testify. Happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Jessen. Next up we have Joel Carlson. Welcome, Mr. Carlson. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Expedia Group. And with the possible exception of the Labor Day school start, I have probably testified on this bill more than any other since 2009, and that's a lot. Mr. Chairman and members, I liked Mr. Jessen's description of the bill better than the author's, because the author left the suggestion that there was local lodging tax that wasn't being paid, right? That they weren't getting that revenue if it's booked online. That is just not true. All of the lodging tax that is owed by a hotelier or hopefully an accommodation provider is paid to the local unit of government, and there are thousands of these. This is not an online tax. This is on every group that provides for lodging. Every tour group, every travel agent, every person that rents out their cabin is an accommodation provider. This says that now those people that the state in 2011 imposed a sales tax on their service fee, and we pay that, we are now going to make them local lodging taxpayers. The legislature never amended local lodging tax to include that this service that we provide as part of accommodations for good reason. Not just the complexity of administering this tax in all the different jurisdictions, but we do not provide lodging. Lodging taxes are paid for lodging. We don't provide lodging, just like the person who mows the grass at the hotel doesn't provide lodging. And we don't charge them a local lodging tax. This just doesn't make sense administratively or from tax policy. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we have serious, continue to have serious concerns about this. We're happy to answer questions. We do pay sales tax on the service fee that we charge, but we don't provide lodging and we don't provide lodging taxes. And the issue about whether it happens where the Department of Revenue collects the tax, that is a very open question, and I can assure you that many, if any, travel accommodation intermediaries are paying that tax is very debatable. They can tell you what the number is, I'm certain, but it's not all the people that are travel intermediaries. So thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Next up, we have Caleb McGuff. McCullough, excuse me, McCullough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Caleb McCullough, and I am the manager of government relations at Hospitality Minnesota. We represent Minnesota's restaurants and food service, hotels and lodging, and resorts and campground sectors. We appreciate the opportunity to offer our perspective and support for House File 3414. This legislation would align the lodging tax for hotel bookings through online travel agencies, creating an even playing field for hotels, and ensuring our convention and visitor bureau partners are receiving the full lodging tax. State statute section 469.190 provides for a lodging tax of up to 3% in participating communities on hotel stays that are less than 30 days. 95% of these proceeds must go towards tourism promotion from local visitors and convention bureaus. The lodging tax is crucial for the hospitality and tourism industry as it drives marketing and promotion of all the great opportunities Minnesota has to offer. In 2022 alone, the lodging tax generated over $84 million across our state. Under the current law, only the seven cities and two counties with state-administered lodging taxes are required to ensure the full portion of an online travel agency's lodging tax is remitted. In the over 100 cities with taxes administered locally, many in greater Minnesota, they do not have to remit the lodging tax on the gap between the sale of the room from the hotel and the sale of the room to the customer. This directly impacts the amount of dollars these communities receive to promote tourism in their area. This bill addresses these inconsistencies and would align the lodging tax benefits statewide. We ask that you support House File 3414 to ensure our local tourism bureaus receive full funding from their locally administered lodging tax. Thank you.
Thank you. Before we go to member discussion, anyone in the audience that would like to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, members, Representative Guam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and one of the testifiers was parsing words, so I'm going to boil this down to the simple thing that the entity that sells to the consumer should be the one collecting and paying taxes and fees. So that that statement would mean somebody online that is collecting payment for that hotel room or lodging would be the one responsible for paying all appropriate taxes and fees, which include state and local. And I think that interpretation is the fairest way to do it, because the establishment is actually a more in the wholesale level on these transactions, because they are not directly interacting with the consumer. And to appropriately get the full price the consumer's paying, in which the fee and taxes would be collected on, you have to go to the entity that is collecting from the consumer that knows that amount. So I think it's appropriate. It closes a, you know, might billable hour interpretation of it. But the, I think the general intent is we want this lodging tax to be on the total cost to the consumer, so we proportionally are funding whatever the specific tourism activities for that locality. So I support the intent, and if there are any loopholes that show up on further reading, I will support making, you know, the intent evident. But thank you.
A whole lot of happiness going on. Yeah. Anyone else? I hope it's happy. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifier. And I'm wondering if, so when Expedia, that's who we're talking about, so whatever X online company collects the fee, do they pay the hotel whatever they're saying? Do they show the fee on the, I've used them a couple times, but I never really paid attention to this. Or is that what they're showing you what you're paying, and they're buying at a wholesale rate from the hotel chain what actually has been paid, and is that what they're paying the tax on? I just a question, and it looks like Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hewitt, excellent question. The consumer is shown a price for the room that is set by the hotelier. Okay, so that is an agreement between the travel agent, whether it's online or not, and the accommodation provider, the hotelier, I'll call them, they have an agreement, okay? You can sell this room for $90, and I agree that your service fee can be, I'll use Mr. Jessen's analogy, $10 for finding that customer, advertising my room and finding that customer for me. Of the $90 that is shown or charged or paid to the hotel by the consumer. Many times they go and pay right at the hotel. You don't pay online, right? You pay right at the hotel. Then they collect the entire lodging tax right at the hotel. Sometimes there's two different models here. The other times the travel agent will collect all of the money. They'll know what the fees are, and they'll remit everything, including the local lodging tax, to the hotel, and they'll retain their service fee. So the is it the all-in price is displayed to the consumer, and the but the question is how much is the service fee and how much is the tax and the local lodging tax. I don't know how detailed those are as it relates to the service fees, but I do know when you check out, not when you check in, but when you check out, those are detailed what those taxes are. But I don't think you're shown that when you make the reservation, but I can find that out for you. But the point is, all of the local lodging tax is paid by the accommodation provider, whether it's a VRBO or a Airbnb or a hotel or a short-term rental. They are responsible for paying that local lodging tax.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Follow up?
Yes, Representative Hewitt.
I don't know. It's so, I guess, and this could go to anybody. I mean, maybe I'll have to wait for the department, but how many actual service fees do we tax in Minnesota?
Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chairman, I know that late at night in 2011, you added about 11 of them, and my company was one of my client was one of them.
2013.
Not 2013, 2011, and during special session, but it's only not bitter about it. It's more like a disgusting bile in the pit of my stomach. So we do not tax very many services, but this is one of them, and we pay a sales tax. And to put it in perspective for what it is, you know, Bloomington has a larger sales local lodging tax than the state sales tax. Their local lodging tax is 7%. It's more than what the state sales tax is, of which we pay. So I'm sure Joanna Byers from Revenue can tell you how many services are taxed, but we are one of them, and we pay sales tax on it. But they're not all lodging providers, and neither are we.
Representative Hewitt.
I'm done, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Chair Gomez.
Thank you, Chair Lissagard. I have kind of the same question as Representative Hewitt, and maybe I just didn't understand your response. So when you, because like your client doesn't pay the when you have an agreement with like a lodging provider, you pay like less, I assume, than you would if you went to the hotel website itself. Maybe that's not true. It's not true. Okay. Because I think that was what Representative Hewitt was trying to ask, was like, are you getting a preferential rate for rooms and then remitting the lodging tax and the sales tax overall based on that price versus what the, you know, that end price is for the consumer?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, the price for the accommodation, the price for the hotel room is set not by the travel agent. It is set by the accommodation provider. So if they say, we will put 10 rooms out on your website at $90, that's what they get, and that's what the companies will try and sell for them. But they set that price. It's not set by at all, ever, by the intermediary. We're marketing their properties, but we don't set the price for the room, and we remit to them the price for the room and all of the taxes that are due. The only thing that they keep out of that transaction is their service fee for doing it.
Chair Gomez.
I guess I'm just, I just need to look more into this because I'm just trying to figure out like what the issue is here, because the way you're presenting it, it seems very plain, but I know that the history of this bill is that it's been in the, you know, department's policy and technical bill for many, many, many years. And, you know, we can compliment your skilled work at keeping it out of that policy and technical bill for many, many, many years. But I'm just trying to understand the dynamics of it. If it is as plain as you are presenting it, then like, I don't exactly understand what the issue is, but I will be looking into it. So thank you very much, Mr. Carlson.
I do see Mr. Jessen. Different perspective.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Nathan Jessen, League of Minnesota Cities. First of all, I think that Mr. Carlson kind of aptly described what I understand to the process to be as far as what is subject to sales tax and what is not. As far as the legislative history behind this, it's been, I think it was first proposed around 2011. This bill, unlike previous iterations, does not have like a retroactive effective date, which has been an issue that's been brought up in the past. But that's kind of the most recent change to this bill compared to how it's been presented in the past. I don't know. I don't know if I totally understand all of your question, I guess.
We'll take it offline. Yeah. Okay, thank you so much. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is maybe a question for the bill author or I guess maybe Mr. Jessen. But we haven't talked about this, and so I just wanted to ask to clarify that if this bill were to be included in the division report and passed, it wouldn't have an effect on the price that consumers pay. And so Chair Gomez asking that question, I think, was maybe getting at kind of what I want to get at, because it's not that because we're not collecting this tax, people get cheaper rooms, right?
I would say that's an accurate statement, yeah.
I mean, as Mr. Carlson noted, the hoteliers set the price for the rooms, right? The question is about on the booking fee for the online travel companies and accommodation intermediaries, are they paying local lodging tax on that portion.
Thank you. Representative Lee?
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Being a simple farm boy, I boil it down to what does the consumer pay? So if my gas tax, if it was a, or any tax, sales tax, et cetera, was on the wholesale price instead of what I pay, there'd be less taxes collected. So My understanding is the confusion is we're not taxing at the rate the consumer pays. Here's what the consumer pays. We take the tax to that. It's really odd to say, well, we're going to tax at the value that was here upstream. And frankly, I don't think that's a really odd situation. And if somebody is really earning their billable hours, being able to get that special difference. And so I don't think that it's at all consistent with what we normally do, because, you know, we should always have it at the point of sale, not upstream somewhere. Because if this is valid, I've got a whole lot of wholesale people that would like to get involved in this avoidance of paying local taxes. So again, I support the efforts of the author and the bill, but if you're going to play special games and say we're prima donnas and we don't, you know, have to have it included. So simple farm boy, it's straightforward. Pay on what the consumer pays and give the cities what they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the interest of time, I would just encourage members of the committee to read the very thorough brief that Mr. Carlson included in our packets. It explains in detail why we should not be doing this bill, why taxes are being paid, and why this is a bad idea. I just think that there's some confusion about what current law is and what the bills do. If you read Mr. Carlson's memo, it thoroughly explains why we should not do this. Thank you.
Thank you. And just for the record, he's a Republican going against Representative Quam. Closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One just sort of clarification. Again, the difference here is between communities where the local lodging tax is state administered, where that local lodging tax is indeed paid on the booking fee, and communities where it is locally administered and it is not. So just to sort of be clear there, I'm not going to deny that this would have obvious benefits for my community, but I think this bill would have benefits truly statewide. Appleton, Brooklyn Center, Brooklyn Park, Iron Range communities, Mr. Chair, Morris, Ortonville, Roseau, Thief River Falls, and War Road are all communities with locally administered lodging taxes represented by members of this committee who would see more of that local lodging tax revenue come into their coffers. Obviously, these play an important role in ensuring that communities, particularly those with smaller tax bases, are able to cultivate a thriving tourism industry. And like I said, I think it is just fundamentally about fairness, and I think we can leave it at that.
Well, thank you for tugging on my heartstrings, mentioning the Iron Range. With that, Representative Coulter renews his motion that House File 3414 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Property Tax Division report. The bill is laid over. Nicely done. That was about as simple as boiling water, to Representative Quam's point. But that concludes our business for today. It is a beautiful day outside. Let's enjoy it. We are adjourned.